Today on Against the Grain, how important is secrecy to the U.S. government? What's changed in the kinds and amounts of information deemed too sensitive to be shared with the general public? I'm C.S. Joseph Mosco has done deep investigation into the nature of secrecy, the designation of threats, and the information-related priorities and obsessions of the U.S. security state. He'll join me coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So much information is being kept under wraps. The public tries to gain access to some of it via Freedom of Information Act requests and other methods, but often those efforts fail, or redactions make the documents actually obtained indecipherable. How did it get to be this way? What does state secrecy have to do with the effort to withhold information about the atom bomb? And what does Joseph Mosco mean when he asserts that official secrecy is a means of re-engineering and militarizing American society? Joseph Mosco is professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago, and his books include The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror, and The Nuclear Borderlands, The Manhattan Project in Post-Cold War New Mexico. He has contributed a chapter about what he calls the security threat matrix to the new volume, Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power, edited by Mark McGuire, Ursula Rao, and Nils Zorowski. When Joseph Mosco joined me recently via Skype, I asked him what the Atomic Energy Act of 1946 did in terms of mandating that certain information be withheld from the U.S. public.
Contextualizing that act is important because coming out of 1945 and particularly the ending acts of World War II, the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with an entirely new kind of technology that had been developed in secret over the previous couple years, and then announced to the world via those acts of city-ending kind of destruction. There is a very real question about what, after World War II, will become the basis for the management of not only nuclear science, but also the information around the bomb in particular. And what the Atomic Energy Act does in its first incarnation, and it's revised a few years later as well, is it establishes a new kind of information in the United States, a kind of information that is technically born secret, which means anything to do with that technology is assumed to be a classified matter until some official makes a formal legal effort to declassify it. And so what it does is it establishes at the center of the security state that is emerging after World War II, which is heavily invested in nuclear power, a secret state right at the center of science and technology and militarism. And it becomes the basis going forward for really thinking about state secrets not as strategic or technical matters, but as things that have potentially city-ending consequences for their revelation. And in the work that I've been doing, I've tracked over, you know, many decades how the idea of state secrecy becomes imbued with these affective charges around the idea that something that the state doesn't want to reveal becomes something that's immediately connected to something super destructive. And given the scope of the security state that emerges after 1945 and this kind of permanent secret state that's at the center of American democracy, this, I think, has huge implications for American society going forward.
And by affective, do you mean kind of on the emotional level?
Yeah, I do. And one of the most challenging aspects, I think, but most important aspects of nuclear politics in the United States is we tend to think of nuclear weapons as technologies and also things that are part of geopolitics They are, you know, state-to-state relations, competitions. There was certainly, you know, 40 years of an arms race with the Soviet Union in which, like, each innovation in technological form really mattered. But I would argue that the primary role of nuclear weapons in American society has been emotional. It's been about constituting a notion of existential danger, of linking citizens to the state through that idea of an external totalizing danger, and then using it as a kind of point of negotiation and manipulation in terms of public perceptions of international affairs going forward. And pretty much kind of every decade from World War II going forward has a kind of formal nuclear scare that can be unpacked with this notion of emotional management at its center.
So the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, as you said, declared that nuclear weapons data was born classified, didn't have to be, as you said, formally classified after the fact. What did the National Security Act of 1947, so this is a year later, what did that law do to the, or vis-a-vis the secretive nature of U.S. government?
Yeah, it's part of this really incredibly substantial series of federal laws that really change how wartime and peacetime are organized in the United States. And we don't actually spend enough time just kind of attending to just what a kind of revolutionary series of decisions were being made in this immediate post-World War II moment. So a couple of things that happen over a series of kind of federal directives in the late 40s, the Department of War becomes the Department of Defense. So formally after World War II, the U.S. doesn't really declare war anymore. It's doing defense, and defense is increasingly imagined as global. So it puts a different valence on what military affairs are aimed at. And of course, it also requires a permanent mobilization, given that defense becomes now a de facto commitment of the state going forward. It's no longer based on dealing with a particular conflict, a particular enemy. And so, you know, we have lived since the late 40s in a world that is, in the United States, that is permanently mobilized and that maintains a large standing army that is involved in lots of covert and overt military actions around the world under this revised notion of defense. And at the very center of that, I would say that the atomic bomb plays just a huge role in that, not only because it becomes the basis for U.S. superpower status, and then a few years later, the Soviet Union enters into that status as well. So it creates a kind of hierarchy of states that have these kind of existential technologies. But it also, across the late 1940s and into the 1950s, one of the kind of formal federal projects was to think about how to mobilize the American public around nuclear danger and to create citizens that could now be remade as Cold War subjects that would support an emerging new kind of conflict against the Soviet Union known as Cold War, but that would also use the minute-to-minute danger of nuclear attack as a way to keep citizens kind of militarized and mobilized on behalf of the government. So that the era that folks of a certain generation remember as civil defense, in which there were, over the course of about 30, 40 years, daily exercises in public schools and a very engaged and deliberate and comprehensive propaganda effort to teach citizens to think about nuclear weapons in a particular way, to introduce them to images of nuclear destruction that were highly curated and designed to produce a certain kind of affective stance towards the bomb. That was very much at the center of the Cold War effort. It was a kind of domestic use of nuclear fear to support a geopolitical project that we think of now as the arms race with the Soviet Union. So the bomb is really crucial to understand as big science, as a project that gets the full support of the state for science and engineering, which has many, many overflowing effects across the disciplines. It's a big part of geopolitics in terms of creating a kind of hierarchy of states and also mobilizing existential danger through nuclear war as the basis for international relations. And then the least understood aspect of that is the role it plays in domestic politics in terms of creating a new citizen subject that is recruited by the state through civil defense, through mass media, to really think about the world, to think about nuclear danger, and to think about the power of the U.S. state in a very particular way.
But one could say that nuclear weapons data, data specifically relating to nuclear weapons, is one kind of information that a government might want to keep secret. You argue in this piece that the government wants to keep all kinds of information secret. And to what extent were linkages made, maybe explicitly or implicitly, by the government between kind of sensitive nuclear weapons data and data that had nothing to do with nuclear weapons, but somehow the government wanted to keep it under wraps?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. Thank you. And partly what we're talking about is the multi-decade kind of expansion of the logics of secrecy within the U.S. So in a simple way, we could think about it as during wartime, every state keeps secrets about what its military affairs are. It's part of the standard logic of warfare. But what happens after World War II is that there's a kind of permanent militarization of U.S. society, which installs then this deep and unprecedented in the U.S. commitment to secrecy around affairs. And that starts to accrue projects over time. And so the piece that we're talking about, as it enters into the 2000s and we have this kind of transformation from kind of Cold War dynamics around secrecy into counter-terror dynamics around secrecy, we just see this really substantial explosion in the number of categories used in federal government that allow the restriction of information. Now, some of this occurs under extremely formal terms that are marked under a hierarchy of classifications that not only keep things secret, but also determine those who have classified access, what access they have to what material. And that has this historical formulation that is built up over many decades of Cold War. But there are also a series of other categorizations that I got very interested in, things that went for about a decade under the title sensitive but unclassified, kinds of material that were never formally designated as classified material, but that were treated by federal agencies as if they were.
Joseph Mosco is my guest. He's professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago, and his chapter about what he calls the secrecy/threat matrix is part of a new volume called Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. Joe's chapter appears in expanded form in his book, The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. And you mentioned the sensitive but unclassified category, and I want to follow up with you, and I will, about that. But just to return to kind of earlier history, you know, the U.S. was the strongest military power in the world, and yet you are saying that the fear of nuclear weapons, nuclear attack, was, of course, instilled in people through these civil defense exercises and through all the other information emanating from the government to the public. So how was this idea of atomic weapons, how did it square with the emphasis that appears to be the case of vulnerability of the U.S. to attack?
Yeah, it's a double-edged dynamic for sure. So even as the United States in the late 40s and into the early 50s has a gigantic kind of technical advantage in terms of the existing type of nuclear weapons that are part of the arsenal and the number. Right away, there is a counter narrative about the vulnerability to future external nuclear states, with the eye on the Soviet Union in particular. And so this idea that nuclear power also comes with nuclear vulnerability is really structural to the post-World War II moment, and it creates, you know, a series of very substantial political commitments and institutions in the U.S. We could think actually about the reestablishment of the Department of Defense and the building out of the modern intelligence agencies, the creation of institutions like the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency in the early 1950s, as deep structural commitments to trying to prevent a kind of surprise like the Pearl Harbor attack, but in a nuclear age. And running through the kind of formulation of this growth of intelligence agencies, which, you know, over 50 years grow to 17, 18 different, you know, highly classified agencies just devoted to intelligence, is this idea of the uncertainty of international affairs in a nuclear age and the incredible consequences for not understanding the dangers of nuclear war. So the modern kind of American national security apparatus, I think, has at its center a couple of linked projects. One is state secrecy and the way in which that functions, not only to manage domestic politics and perceptions of nuclear technologies, but also as just a kind of basic bureaucratic means of creating a hierarchy of subjects that have differential access to information around particularly defense-related technologies. So it's probably not known to many of your viewers that the way in which secrecy functions in the U.S. is that people with security classifications have need-to-know access. And so two people who work on nuclear weapon science, let's say, might have very different kinds of security clearances. They might be accessed to only interact with certain aspects of the technical side of weapon science and not others.
And this leads, as you write, to a kind of compartmentalization of information and of secrecy. With what consequences if some people in government know certain things because they have access to certain information and other people don't because they have access to other kinds of information?
Right. It sets up a dynamic that is very little understood in terms of even folks out of, my world in anthropology that write and think a lot about secrecy. In anthropology, one of the insights around secret societies, going back over 150 years of different kinds of assessments around the world, is that, you know, the content of the secret is less important than the social structural work that secrecy itself does, the way in which it arranges people in terms of power, in terms of social access, in terms of political hierarchies.
Well, on that topic, what advice did Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame, what advice did he give to Henry Kissinger just before Kissinger became Secretary of State?
Yeah, this is a really serious quotation from Ellsberg's autobiography in which, having had security clearances above top secret for the previous decade or so, and having worked very intensely on nuclear warfighting plans, Ellsberg is meeting with Kissinger to kind of tell him, as he's becoming National Security Advisor, what it will be like to finally get access to all the information that one imagines to be out there, but which, by virtue of one's prior clearance, one hasn't had access to. And he walks through a whole series of steps in which he says, you know, you're going to be exhilarated because finally, you know, there's no more barriers to knowledge and you're going to have access to everything. And then as you work through the various files that you now have clearance to read, you're going to start being really disappointed at the quality of the information that's in those files, because, you know, part of expectation is magnification. And you're going to find that the files aren't as complete as you like, the information is more dodgy or slippery than you'd like. And then Ellsberg starts to say that this is going to work on you for a while, and you're going to start meeting with people who have clearances that are lower than yours, and you're going to spend all of your time managing the structure of secrecy itself, trying to not give away what you know that the person you're meeting with isn't clear to understand. And then also secondarily, you're going to be asking yourself all the way through, if this person knew what I knew, had my clearances, would they be telling me the same thing that they're telling me? And then Ellsberg makes this kind of incredible comment. He just says, you're going to become something like a moron because you're going to be unable to trust anybody, even those people that have much more technical expertise than you do in a given field, because you will be so tied to managing the system of classifications. And then Ellsberg concludes by saying, the only reason I can say this to you is because this is my experience, how I've interacted with people. This is my own kind of arc with having had no clearances to working up through the hierarchy to gaining many of the most sensitive clearances around nuclear weapons in particular.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joseph Masco is my guest, M-A-S-C-O. He teaches anthropology at the University of Chicago. His books include The Nuclear Borderlands, The Manhattan Project in Post-Cold War New Mexico, and The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. And part of what Joe argues in The Theater of Operations can be found in a chapter that he has contributed to a new volume. It's called Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. It's edited by Mark McGuire, Ursula Rao, and Nils Zorowski. It's published by Duke University Press. So your chapter in this text, Bodies as Evidence, invokes a term. It's called the secrecy threat matrix. And you've already begun to trace the contours of this term. Secrecy, I'm sure, relates to state secrecy, and threat relates, because I've read your piece, to the perceived threat posed by allowing sensitive information to get into the wrong hands or get out into the public. But can you tell us more about what you mean by the secrecy threat matrix?
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about the secrecy threat matrix concept, which is a way of thinking about the work of secrecy in the U.S. as through the Manhattan Project into the early Cold War period, it becomes supercharged with nuclear danger and becomes then the basis for the kind of prototypical state secret. So after World War II, we have an expanding set of institutions that are organizing themselves as secret agencies, a proliferation of intelligence agencies, a proliferation of defense agencies, a gigantic state bureaucracy, which is quite unprecedented for a democracy, which assumes that none of the activities of the world of defense and intelligence can be shared with citizens because there's danger attached to sharing, to transparency, and even in many most basic forms of accountability. And so I was thinking as I was reviewing this kind of long arc of the Cold War as it transforms in the early 2000s into the War on Terror, and was realizing that just one of the most profound effects of the nuclear revolution was to embed within the federal government a commitment to secrecy, but more than that, the kind of rhetorical and political commitment to the idea that every state secret is the equivalent of the nuclear secret, which means that the cost for revelation is not simply as it is in 99.9% of the matters of the state, a question of bureaucracy, a question of the day-to-day operations of a giant bureaucracy, but that there is some existential cost attached to transparency in the domain of the defense worlds and the intelligence worlds. And as the U.S. builds out a significant global infrastructure of military basing, of covert actions around the world, and a deep and abiding domestic commitment to nuclear weapons and other related technologies, we have a fundamental contradiction, I think, built into the democratic state form that resides in the nuclear revolution, which has to do with this notion that knowledge equals danger, that secrecy somehow protects the domestic order from some kind of existential event. And this has had a couple of very significant effects in terms of what we might just think of this as the social contract. One of them is that anybody who gets near state secrets is prosecuted. And so we have, after late 1940s, early 1950s, going forward, a new category of prosecution around a state secrets privilege, in which people who are bringing claims against the federal government or the military or a federal agency can have the case thrown out because the information in the accusation or in the litigation involves something that the state marks as a state secret. And so we have a long history now of very serious issues of public integrity, of questions of accidents and of unintended violence by defense organizations being tossed out of court simply because the state secret clause is evoked to disallow the hearing itself. In the early 2000s, this was used over and over again for a number of individuals who were picked up by CIA and related groups and subjected to forms of torture and then released under conditions that they were either misidentified or subjected to illegal treatment. And those cases have been thrown out of court simply because of the power of the state secret. So in the larger argument that I make in the book and the article, this tracks back to the conceptual power of linking existential danger in the form of nuclear weapons to state secrecy. And it's had, I think, a significant effect on modes of accountability in the U.S., but also just changing the social contract so that there are great domains of, the most serious matters in the life of a country, and taking those away from citizen-state conversations at all under the logic of the state secret. So the secrecy threat matrix is a way of saying, and also hopefully of alerting your listeners and people who hopefully read the book, to the modalities of American life in which figures in elected office or through the Defense Department or through the intelligence agencies say essentially, we can't talk about this thing because it's too dangerous to talk about it. And to really interrogate those moments as profound moments of public manipulation and quite often misrecognition of what the actual terms, the political terms, the policy terms, the economic terms of those specific moments are actually about.
Joseph Mosco is his name, and he is author of, among other books, The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. We'll take a short break and speak more with Joe about his very interesting work. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joseph Mosco is professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. And we are talking about a chapter I came across about what he calls the secrecy/threat matrix. It's part of a new volume. It's called Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. So we've talked to some degree about the Cold War And the emotion management, perception management campaign that was used by the U.S. government to, as you write and as you've kind of said, reprogram people, reprogram just U.S. residents as cold warriors. You write that it was about teaching people to fear the bomb and fusing that fear with anti-communism. Now, you've said a little bit about the war on terror, the more recent so-called war on terror. What did the George W. Bush administration do after 9/11 in the arena of government control over information?
Oh, yeah, it's a huge question. So in 2001, with the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington and the related set of anthrax mailings that were aimed at politicians and folks in the media, there was a very formal effort in the George W. Bush White House to think about how to re-energize and, in a sense, redirect the national security state to a new set of concerns, namely a figuration of a terrorist as a non-state actor, but also someone that could not be reasoned with and that was completely committed to doing mass violence. And under that configuration, there was a secondary project of looking back to the early Cold War state and thinking about how in the aftermath of World War II, and particularly after the Soviets' first nuclear test in 49, how American society was mobilized around nuclear fear and through both the creation of new federal agencies and new educational campaigns, particularly through civil defense, created what was known, you know, in political science and national security domains for a long time as the Cold War consensus, which had to do with a particular orientation towards geopolitics, a set of ideas about how those forms of anti-communism related to domestic politics fused with a deep multi-generational commitment to science and engineering, and particularly running continual Manhattan projects around military technologies.
So are you saying that the George W. Bush administration was looking for lessons from the past, what it could draw from Cold War strategies in terms of population management, perception management?
Yes, absolutely. And the crucial place to look for any of your listeners who kind of want to see the core text for understanding how radical the 2001 decisions are is to go to the authorization of force from late September 2001, which was signed by Congress and authorized the George W. Bush administration to not only send troops into Afghanistan to fight al-Qaeda and those that were attributed with the first round of 9/11 attacks. But also, there's a crucial line in the authorization of force, which says that the president is authorized to use the capacities as commander-in-chief to prevent all future acts of terror. And that act is not bounded by time, by any particular enemy designation, and it also endows the president with the capacity to decide what is an act of terror and what should be the United States' response to it. And so basically since 2001, most military activities around the world, and the U.S. has been involved all around the world, literally, and has troops in many, many different countries and special forces in many more, using that authorization of force as an effort to prevent any notion of future terror. And so in a sense, that 2001 authorization of force creates the future itself as the problem that needs to be managed. And it creates a notion of counterterror that is endless. It also creates a form of war that can't be won, because if you think about this in a kind of literal way, when can terror be eliminated from the human experience? And it suggests that the entire existential concept that was established during the Cold War kind of nuclear danger has been reformatted for this new kind of conflict. And so absolutely in 2001, 2002, Bush administration officials are literally reading the policy guidance and the debates of the late 40s and 1950s and are thinking about how to build a counterterrorist state that could be as long-lasting as the Cold War state. And there are direct parallels.
Yeah, and this must have created quite an urgency on their part to protect information, to keep information about terror operations or terror possibilities from the public. What happened to the rate at which records over 25 years old were declassified?
It's a really important story. And partly we'd need to back up a little bit to the really unusual moment of the mid-1990s when the U.S. for the first time wasn't formally at war, and the Soviet Union had, of course, dissolved. And there was a widespread effort, particularly also because of the innovation of the internet, to do declassification and to think about opening up federal archives that were closed under all sorts of secrecy restrictions for the public good, for democracy, for scholarship, and so on. And so there is a few years, really in the mid-1990s, where quite a lot of historical material, mostly over 50 years old, certainly over 25 years old, were declassified, and it significantly contributed to changes in the scholarship of U.S. politics, U.S.-Soviet relations in the second part of the 20th century. What the 9/11 event does, and the decisions of the Bush administration afterwards, is to suggest that information once again becomes a fundamental danger to the state and needs to be protected. In October of 2001, John Ashcroft, then as Attorney General, sends out a notice to all federal agencies to essentially slow down Freedom of Information Act requests and, wherever possible, to resist participating in the Freedom of Information Act law as part of a general strategy of slowing down and restricting information across the federal government. A related aspect of this, which is really extremely hard to kind of account for, is also the technological revolution that is happening in information technologies, not just the internet, but also social media. And one of the large-scale information gathering projects centered through agencies like the National Security Agency around counterterror measures is to think about digital information itself now as something that could be collected increasingly in a comprehensive way to create, you know, historical depth and data archives, and also to be able to link how pretty much every individual that has access to a computer or a cell phone or a credit card exists in global data. And related to that, there are a whole series of new theories about what data is and how it can be used in comprehensive forms, collecting across many different sources to do strategic kind of work that informs a general reluctance across federal agencies to be open and transparent in ways that just a decade earlier were quite normal and accepted and even enthusiastically embraced as part of a democratic society.
You spoke earlier about the sensitive but unclassified category of information. This is information removed from public circulation as if it were classified. So this is a kind of a new, right, sensitive but unclassified. It's a new category. When was this category created, and what guidelines are in place to help federal agencies make the determination of whether a certain piece of information is sensitive but unclassified?
Yes. Well, it's quite a story. And part of it goes back to the 1980s and a fellow named John Poindexter, who at that point was part of the Reagan administration and was also tied up in the Iran-Contra scandal. But he had the idea of creating a set of protocols around government information that created categories for restricting the circulation. And some of that had to do with commercial matters, things that might be subject to patents. Some of it had to do with just privacy matters around personnel. But crucially, what it sets in motion is it offers each federal agency the opportunity to decide how to treat the non-classified information that is running through their computers and their various file systems. And it starts a process of building an increasing number of categories and ways in which information that might have circulated easily in a public domain become increasingly restricted. And the crucial bit about the category is that it's not subject to the federal laws around classified information. It's a kind of separate domaining of state information and a way of restricting its circulation.
So people can't challenge the designation of a certain piece of information as sensitive but unclassified?
It becomes increasingly difficult, and whereas in the Freedom of Information Act or FOIA domains, people can ask for an explanation for why a given piece of information wasn't provided under the guidelines of that law and can also appeal. The sensitive but unclassified designation had no such apparatus around it. And it also allowed, you know, each agency to create its own parallel logics of what constituted sensitive information. And that's the crucial thing to attend to here, that sensitive isn't defined by federal law. It is a general category in which, you know, agencies can make their own determinations. And so this rides on top of the formal classification system that has existed back to World War II, that has a set of criteria, laws, logics of adjudication around them. And what's happened in the last few years is an effort to go around to federal agencies that started in the Obama years to try to actually just systematize even the terms that different federal agencies are using that evoke the concept of sensitive but unclassified, to try to systematize and come up with a overarching kind of logic across federal agencies. But in general, one of the very profound effects of the war on terror has been a general restriction on the circulation of state information and increasing use of litigation, as well as versions of the sensitive but unclassified concept to restrict public access.
Joseph Mosco joins me. He is professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago. We're talking about a chapter he contributed to the new volume, Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. And that chapter by Joe appears in expanded form in his book, The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Secrecy is also a fundamental part of U.S. covert operations. Chalmers Johnson wrote about covert operations. What did he say about what those operations, which are kept secret by definition from the U.S. public, what they do to the intelligibility, to the U.S. public's ability to make sense of actions taken in response to those covert operations, say abroad?
Yeah, it's a really serious point that Chalmers Johnson makes. I mean, he kind of began this argument by counting up the number of U.S. military bases around the world. And depending on what you decide is a military base, you know, it's somewhere between 800 and 1,000 outside the United States. So this is, you know, he notices is a completely unprecedented global project of garrisoning the planet in a way. And connected to all those bases are, of course, not only troops, but also special operations forces. I think as of 2017, the costs of war project at Brown College, part of the Watson Institute, documented that U.S. had special forces in some 130 nations around the world. And what Johnson says is that he turns to the CIA concept of blowback as a way to also think about the long-term consequences of covert militarism for American political culture.
Right, and blowback is kind of the phenomenon of retaliating, of others retaliating against the U.S. for what the U.S. has done.
Exactly. And what Johnson says is that there's two aspects to the concept of blowback. One is that there's retaliation to some kind of U.S. Militarism, counterterrorism, covert action. And the crucial secondary bit, which isn't as well understood or talked about, is that because of the way secrecy functions in the domestic politics of the United States, those initial actions by U.S. agents are never publicized at home. And so there is no context for understanding the terms of a retaliation against U.S. militarism abroad in some way. And what that creates then is, from a domestic American point of view, the idea that the world is irrational, that there are entities out there that are committing forms of violence that have no relationship to ongoing U.S. activities, that there's no interaction between, you know, this kind of extraordinary U.S. Militarism abroad and local politics, that the world is kind of unknowable and hyper-violent. And that fits very comfortably within the definition of counterterror as defined by the George W. Bush administration. In a world that is hyper-violent and unknowable, one needs all sorts of militarized reactions to that. And that was one kind of definitional logic of the emerging counterterror state after 2001. So for Chalmers Johnson, democracy is deformed by the way secrecy prevents an understanding of what U.S. is doing around the world in both overt and covert ways, and makes the world less and less intelligible over time, and invites arguments for ever greater militarization in an effort to protect the United States from these perceived forms of irrational violence that in fact have connections to ongoing U.S. activities abroad.
So as we wrap up here, I want to come back, Joe, to this argument you are making that secrecy has ubiquitous effects, that nobody is immune from the distorting effects of U.S. state secrecy. You said earlier that U.S. society is becoming implicitly militarized. What do you mean by that, and how do you want to kind of sum up your sense of how the residents of the U.S. are affected by this overwhelming context of secrecy, the effort by the U.S. to keep information out of the public's hands?
Well, we're speaking in 2019, so we're 18 years into the war on terror. The U.S. has fought a series of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that have been widely critiqued as military debacles. They've been hyper-violent affairs that have not produced democratic orders as promised within those states and have had huge, huge casualty counts. And I refer everybody again to the Watson Institute at Brown University's Cost of War Project, which is an effort to do a kind of real-time just accounting for the costs of war in terms of dead and injured, in terms of money, in terms of refugee status. And the U.S. has been involved in just really an extraordinary act of global violence over the last two decades in retaliation for the 9/11 attacks quite formally. And we don't have at any point really in American society right now a consideration, a detailed discussion, an evaluation of the cost of the decision-making, the moral responsibility for violence on that scale, let alone an effort to think about the next decade of counterterror, because there is no end in sight for this notion of a really global scale deployment of American power on behalf of preventing terrorist acts in the future. And we've also have a military budget in this country that grows with each year, with not only no accountability for how that money has been spent, but also any of the activities of that vast set of agencies and interests and technologies over time. I think that the long-term effects of the secrecy threat matrix on American society is to freeze out a robust democratic debate about militarism. And if the U.S. government is committed to permanent war, and there is not a robust civilian debate about what it authorizes its federal government to do in its name, then there is a serious deformation of democratic politics. And I think it's high time and an important project for everybody to think about what are the institutions that create that dynamic. Some of those are at the federal government level. Some of those happen at the level of affect and management and the way in which fears of the future and fears of imminent violence are constituted and transmitted. Some of them have to do with imaginaries of, you know, what the future dangers are and deep structural problems in American political life around race and ethnicity that are highly challenging to talk about, but that are at the core of counterterror programming. And so the question of how you maintain a militarized society that runs military bases all over the world, that has special forces involved in most states around the world, that also maintains the state-of-the-art nuclear arsenal and maintains the capacity to threaten the rest of the world in terms of nuclear danger, while also saying it's not a militarized society, that it's not committed to imperialist projects, that it is doing this only under the name of kind of necessary defense, is one of the most important conversations I think that the country needs to have. And it's extremely challenging to have a robust conversation around these themes, which is one of the great reasons that I'm happy to be on Against the Grain today, precisely because we get to have this chance. So I'm grateful to UCS for inviting me to be on.
Well, I'm grateful for your insights. Joseph Masco, again, M-A-S-C-O. You can read more about his insights into secrecy and threat in The Theater of Operations, National Security Affect from the Cold War to the War on Terror, which is one of Joe's books. And I found a chapter he wrote for the new volume, Bodies as Evidence, Security, Knowledge, and Power. Thanks so much, Joe, for your work and for joining us.
It's my great pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.